This session is on the church and apartheid in South Africa, and my name is John de Grouchy. What I'm going to attempt this evening is to talk a little bit about the various church groups in South Africa and the way in which they relate to what we call apartheid. Rather difficult to do this in one session because it assumes a great deal of background. Last week I had the advantage of being able to spend 5 sessions on preparing the way to discussing what we are discussing this evening, so it's a little difficult to plunge in, as it were, at the deep end and try and fit into the allotted time what needs to be done. If any of you want to read further around this theme, although it's a bit invidious, I possibly can commend my own book called The Church Struggle in South Africa. As I was saying the other night, the foreword by Alan Payton is regarded as the better part of the book. So if you want to read that foreword, I think worth reading. But the rest of the book will tell you more about what I'm attempting to tell this evening, perhaps a little hurriedly and simply. It's now no longer on sale in the bookshop, it's sold out, but Mary Schrag says that if you want a copy, she can order that for you. And a more recent volume, which is published in England and in South Africa and is about to come out in North America, is called Apartheid is a Heresy, which I've edited together with a colleague of mine, and it will come out, I think, next month. There are several other books here in the bookstore and, of course, many others on South Africa. Well, let me start by saying that insofar as a country can be labelled Christian, I think it would be fair, though I wouldn't want to do it myself, to call South Africa a Christian country. Its constitution indicates as much, and at least 80% of the population, both black and white, the population of 26 million, belong to some Christian church. And if you happen to be in South Africa on a Sunday, you will see quite clearly that this is not simply a book membership, but people in fact go to church. The churches are generally full, people tithe or give a fair amount of money to the church. There's a great deal of Christian presence in the country. And Christianity has shaped South African history. From the beginning of the colonial period, when the first white settlers came to the Cape in 1652, right until today, Christianity and the church, or the churches, have had a major role in shaping the kind of society in which we live, for good or ill. And there's a bit of both. A lot of ill, but also a fair amount of good. Indeed, the church in South Africa must be held responsible to at least a significant degree for having formulated the policy of apartheid, and I'll be saying more about that in a moment. The church has had an important role in shaping the policies of racial separation. But on the other hand, the church in South Africa has also been in the forefront of opposition to apartheid. In fact, many would say that the major institution in the country today that is against apartheid and that is struggling for equality and justice and reconciliation between the various racial and ethnic groups is the church. And that is borne out by the fact that very often when the a state takes action against the opponents of apartheid, they are church leaders, or the books that are banned are written by theologians or what have you. Of course, the church against apartheid is not the only institution fighting apartheid. There are others which we won't be able to talk about tonight, but I want to make that point right at the beginning. The church in South Africa is divided right down the middle On the one hand, one can talk about the church as creating or helping to create and sustain apartheid, and to try and justify it according to the Bible and according to Christian faith and belief. And on the other hand, the church is strongly opposed to apartheid. Now, what I'm going to attempt to do this evening is to unpack these two different sides to the church and try and help you to understand something of the dynamics at work within the church in South Africa along those lines. Now, if anybody has a question as we go along, please don't hesitate to interrupt me if you can get a word in. The odds are you won't be able to, but if you try hard, you'll manage. And it may be that there is an important question that needs to be answered before we can go further, because often, particularly foreigners like myself may use a word or an idiom or an expression that just doesn't mean anything in North America or means the very opposite of what you intend. Like when my wife said that she got up to go and fetch coffee some years ago, she said to her neighbor, "Don't let anybody pinch my seat while I'm away." So, if I say anything like that, you laugh and I didn't expect you to, or I laughed and you didn't, then please indicate, "Hey, what do you mean by that word? Who are these strange people?" Or, "Gee, what is apartheid? I've never heard that word in my life. What are you talking about?" Or maybe if you don't know that, you may want to go and have another cup of coffee or something. But if there is any problem at this point in time, maybe right now somebody might have a question. Okay. Let's proceed then and try and unpack the story of the church in South Africa, the story of a church with two faces. The Dutch Reformed Church came with the first settlers to the Cape in 1652, and for 150 years there was no other church in the Cape Colony, which later expanded to become South Africa. So for 150 years you have this Dutch Calvinist church, the church of the white Dutch settlers, and a few of the slaves and other indigenous people being evangelized, not many because the Dutch Calvinists weren't great evangelists or missioners amongst non-European people. The Dutch Reformed Church was the church, and the only other group of Christians that existed in the country were some German Lutherans who were not allowed to build a church building until 1789 or around about there. So we kept the Lutherans effectively out, or at least the Dutch Calvinists did. Probably in Europe there was a reason for that. Maybe the Lutherans kept the Calvinists out in some village or something. I don't know. But when the British came to the Cape in the beginning of the 19th century, that opened up the whole Pandora's box for every church of your choice to enter into South Africa. Along with the British authorities came the Church of England, the Anglican Church, and also British missionary societies, the London Missionary Society, that was the Congregational Church's missionary outreach, the Methodist Missionary Society, the Presbyterian Church of Scotland Mission, and then a bunch of other missions from Europe, the Berlin Missionary Society, the Rhenish Missionary Society, and from North America, the American Board Mission, and a whole bunch of others. So after 150 years of Dutch Calvinist Christianity in the Cape Colony, suddenly the door was opened and in came a whole new range of denominations, Anglo-Saxon, European, North American. They came in two forms. One, to evangelize the indigenous black people of South Africa. And on the other hand, to be the church of the settlers, the new waves of settlers who were coming in. The English and the Scottish and the Irish and the Cornish and some more Europeans from the continent. So that the church grew up in two forms in South Africa, quite apart now from the Dutch Reformed Church. It grew up as denominations serving the white settlers, but also the missionary societies from those European denominations serving the indigenous people, and somehow trying to put the two together, not very successfully, so that in most little towns or cities as they emerged, you'd have a white Presbyterian church and probably somewhere else a Presbyterian mission church, related but not integrated. Whereas over here you had the Dutch Reformed Church, largely, virtually totally white, but beginning to see that if they didn't join in the evangelization of the indigenous peoples, as all these missionary societies were doing, then they were going to lose out. So the Dutch Reformed Church began to develop its own missionary strategy for the indigenous people. So already we now can see, on the one hand, this Afrikaans or Dutch-speaking church with its Calvinist roots, tentatively now seeking ways to evangelize the black population. And these largely English-speaking churches, largely Protestant, well, virtually totally Protestant, the Catholic story is another story which we won't go into right now, growing up, ministering to both at the same time, to white and black alike, but not quite knowing how to put the two together. Well, let's come back now to the Dutch Reformed Church and see how that church evolved and how out of that church came the pattern for what we now call apartheid. Early on in the 19th century, at a Dutch Reformed Synod, one of the earliest synods of that church, because until the 19th century, the church was controlled from Amsterdam. Around about 1829, at the synod, it was decided that it would be against the word of God to segregate the church into black and white. It would be against the word of God to segregate the church. This was a decision of the Dutch Reformed Synod in 1829. By the 1850s, the synod had shifted its ground and said, although it would be against the word of God to segregate the church, and although it would be against our confessions, nevertheless, for the weakness of some, referring to some whites, many whites, because of the weakness of some, and because we need to work out a missionary strategy and policy, it has become desirable to segregate. So that you would have a black Dutch Reformed Church and a white Dutch Reformed Church. And that laid the mission policy for the Dutch Reformed Church, which finally evolved into four separate denominations. The White Dutch Reformed Church, the so-called Colored Dutch Reformed Church or Mission Church, then the Black Dutch Reformed Church, and then the Dutch Reformed Church that grew out of their evangelization amongst the Indians. Four separate churches ministering to people according to their ethnic, racial background. Okay? Now, to complicate the story a little further, the Dutch Reformed Church itself, the big White Dutch Reformed Church, which today numbers well over 1.5 million, and when you think of South Africa only having 4.5 million white people, the Dutch Reformed Church having 1.5 million of them, and they're all in, and all the members of the cabinet and many of the members of parliament belong to that church, you get some idea of the strength of that church. Well, that White Dutch Reformed Church, as a result of some historical developments like the Great Trek, divided into three. So there are in fact three white Dutch Reformed Churches in South Africa. The conservative big one, the more conservative smaller one called the Gereformeerde Kerk, and then the right-wing one called the Hervormde Kerk, near the Deutsch Hervormde Kerk. Now we're going to leave those two relatively small ones, numbering not more than 250,000 each. Okay, so already we've got 2 million people within that church family, but we're going to leave those two small ones on the side and concentrate mainly with the big one, the big Dutch Reformed Church, with its mission policy of having separate churches for separate races. And that was not just a practical thing, that was now going to be a principle, a matter of principle, that that's how the church should be divided. I might say that one of the churches, one of the other Dutch Reformed Churches, the Niederdeutsche Hervormde Kerk, has an article in its constitution which says no person who is not white can belong to this church. But we're not talking about that very right-wing church. Now, as that mission policy worked out, so it laid the foundation for a political vision that maybe it's God's will that people should develop separately. If it's God's will that the church should be divided racially, maybe it's God's will that people of different races and ethnic groups should not only worship separately, but also live separately and develop their own cultural institutions separately, and so forth and so on. So you're beginning to get theologically grounded the embryonic policy of apartheid, coming out of the Dutch Reformed Church's missionary policy. that each person should hear the gospel in his own language and worship in his cultural setting, but separate from any of the others. Now you might say, well gee, what's wrong with that? We Lutherans do exactly the same, or the Mennonites do the same, and we could go through the whole range of churches in North America and see how much culture shapes Christianity and the church to which you belong. Well, you might want to wrestle with that question sometime, maybe even tonight. Now what was happening to the, I might say at this point that the policy of apartheid itself, of course, didn't only come out of the Dutch Reformed Church's mission policy, but it emerged in the struggle against British control and imperialism, a very powerful force in South Africa, and Afrikaner nationalism was a reaction to British imperialism. I happen to be of British extraction, and whenever I read the story of the way in which the British try to control the Afrikaner and his culture and so on, it always makes me feel a little ill. Apartheid was partly, it came out of that Afrikaner nationalist reaction to British imperialism, but it also came out of the Afrikaner experience of feeling overwhelmed by a vast black majority population in the country, outnumbered by perhaps today 5-1, 5 black to 1 white, and the tremendous sense of needing to maintain identity and control, control over the present but also over the future, over the destiny of one's people and children and culture and language, everything else. If you want to get some feel for how the Afrikaner understands his plight in South Africa, then just think about North America for a moment, and let's just say that in North America the population ratios were reversed, that there were 20 million whites in North America and 200 million blacks in North America, and the whites had the power. And they weren't too sure what would happen if they gave up that power. Then you've got a parallel. You see, in North America, when you talk about blacks, you're talking about a minority group struggling for equal rights. In South Africa, you're talking about a minority group struggling to keep power. Okay, and that's a very fundamental difference, though there are many similarities. So when you ask what makes many white South Africans tick, then it is fear. Fear for what might happen. Because while the Civil Rights Act here was an important turning point, perhaps in the history of... I mean, you didn't feel threatened by that unless you lived in Louisiana or somewhere. But in South Africa, if you had that political change, you would have a dramatic change. Okay, and you've got to understand that to understand why the policy of separate development or apartheid has such a powerful grip on South Africa, on white South Africa. It is a way of maintaining power.
Question.
Yeah.
This is back. This is not exactly where you are.
It's okay.
Is there among the whites of South Africa kind of a consciousness of their national strategy? You marry an English girl. Why? Why do you marry a South African girl? I mean a girl with such reformed ambition.
You mean why didn't I marry one like that? Yeah, well you do get that cross.
But does everybody know if I am of English?
Well, yeah, because you speak English. You don't speak Afrikaans as your home language. It's like marrying a good Lutheran girl from Minnesota of Norwegian extract. You know, there are cultural similarities. You have the same sense of humor.
But everybody's very much aware of where they're coming from.
Yeah, oh sure. Although that begins to, you know, fade. I mean, my family's been in South Africa for 100 years. So, I'm third generation. My father was born there. My grandfather arrived, then my father, and now me and my children. Okay, that's second going into third generation. So I guess that some of your families haven't been in North America 100 years, have they? Huh? Some of you, yeah. Have all of you been here 100 years? Yeah. Okay. Good. Some of you look like you have been. Right. Now, was that funny? Yes. Yeah. Ich kann Afrikaans praat. Can you plat Deutsch verstaan?
No.
Good.
But do all white people speak
You learn both in school. You learn both in school. But you see, can you hold that? That gets more complicated. You see, to come back to your question, which is a very real question, why did I marry my wife? Well, now, I've often said, why did I marry my wife? So thank you for forcing me to try and answer that question. Well, I won't tell you all the reasons, but
diversity that had an
therefore had more chance of meeting and understanding each other and falling in love. Okay? If, however, my parents had said, we think you should go to an Afrikaans-speaking university because you need to find out about that side of the culture of South Africa, it may well be that I would have fallen in love with an Afrikaans girl. But the chances of that were a little more remote, simply because that would have been a fairly important decision to do that against the mainstream decision was to do the other. Okay? The obvious thing to do was to go to Rhodes University at that time, which was an English-speaking university.
But what you're saying is there continues to be a kind of homogenization among white people in South Africa.
Well, there's both separation, because you have Afrikaans schools and English schools. And if, and I'm talking about junior and high schools, if you are Afrikaans-speaking, by law you go to an Afrikaans-speaking school. And by law you go to an English-speaking school if you are English, white English. Okay? So the cleavage between Afrikaans-speaking and English-speaking is almost, not the same, but almost as real as between black and white. Okay? You've got to understand that. And you see this running through every sphere of life, from your primary school days through your high school days, the newspapers you read, the groups that you meet with, the church that you belong to, the university you may go to, and the company that you may work for.
Economics?
Yeah. There are some mining companies which are English mining companies and some which are quite clearly Afrikaans mining companies.
Would just English-speaking, well, I don't know how you refer to that? I mean, as opposed to the Afrikaans-speaking...
English-speaking South African.
Does the English-speaking South African find himself limited in any way, then? Is he behind the eight ball economically?
No, he finds himself very limited politically.
Politically?
Because, you see, all power is in the hands of the whites. But the English-speaking whites are in a minority. So there's no way whereby, politically, we can change the system, at least through the normal channels of politics.
Well, not only in terms of the numbers of votes, but also in terms of the bureaucratic position?
Yeah, right. I mean, in the town where I was a pastor for 10 years, virtually every important official in that, well, it was a village, from the police chief through to the high school principal, through to the local postmaster, and you name it, were all elders in the Dutch Reformed Church.
If Missioner, I don't know, you haven't said nothing about him and Covenant yet,
yes.
But if there's anything to that, it sounded to me when I read it that as if it was a bureaucrat who devised and implemented apartheid.
Oh yeah, that's true today, yes, yeah, sure. It's a bureaucratic system that's maintained by bureaucrats. And if apartheid had to go, tens of thousands of people will be out of work because they won't have that machinery to oil and to grease and to maintain. So if your whole life has been a life of working your way up the ladder in terms of the apartheid bureaucracy, you don't want to see that go because that means that your livelihood will go. Okay?
You mean tens of thousands?
I mean tens of thousands, yeah. Well, I mean you have tens of thousands working in Washington keeping your bureaucracy going. Okay, now this is more complicated, let me tell you. All right, let's get back. Thank you for the question, that was a good question. I hope my wife's not listening. Are you asleep up there or are you awake? Now, let's look at the English-speaking churches for a moment. As I said, they came in two forms. One, to minister to the English settlers who came out, or the Cornish settlers. My wife was Cornish by background. My grandfather was from Jersey Island, and it's such a complicated story, I'm not going to even try and tell it. The Cornish miners, or the Scottish farmers, or the English shopkeepers, or whoever it was, they brought out that particular denomination to which they belonged. Some of them were Methodist lay preachers. Okay, and they had ministers come out from England to minister to them and to their little congregations as they grew up in the frontier towns and in Cape Town and other cities like Port Elizabeth. And then there were the Methodist missionaries and the Scottish missionaries and so on. And you had these little mission churches. Now, two things happened. As these Methodist or Presbyterian denominations grew up, either the mission church and the settler church came together to form one denomination as that denomination emerged. Because to begin with, it wasn't a denomination, there were congregations. But as they grew, so a denomination emerged. One way to do that was to put the mission and the settler congregations together, not necessarily on a Sunday to worship together, because language might have prevented that. In my own church today, which is 90% black, there are 10 languages that are spoken. Keep that in mind. 10 languages are spoken in my denomination. All right? 10 languages are used in worship. 10 languages are used when people preach. So there's a language cultural problem in putting that mission congregation and that white congregation together in that little town somewhere in the middle of the country. But nevertheless, at a synodical level, at a regional level, at a national level, those mission and settler congregations came together to form so-called multiracial churches. Okay? And that's what you have today amongst the Congregational, Presbyterian, Methodist, Anglican, and Roman Catholic, and some Lutheran churches are multiracial as a result of that process of coming together over the last 150 years. And most of those have a majority of a black membership, none quite as dramatic as the church to which I belong, but there are at least 60 to 70% black Anglicans within the Anglican Church, and probably of the million odd Catholics, million and a half Catholics in the country, a good 750,000 would be black, and so you might go on. But now you have these multiracial churches with this large black constituency, and somehow trying to keep together because you have language and cultural and political differences of all kinds. And although to begin with these churches, when this doctrine of separation was emerging at the turn of the century and especially as the Afrikaner rose to power in the 20s and 30s and 40s, although they didn't say a great deal about racism, there were some voices. Once apartheid was formulated and came to power in 1948 with a National Party government, these churches began to speak out from 1948 onwards, some voices before that, against apartheid, saying this was, from a Christian point of view, immoral, wrong, and so on. So for the last 30, 40 years, there has been that voice within these so-called English-speaking churches, a voice against apartheid. And that's understandable when you bear in mind that most of the members are black. Okay? Although the spokesmen for the last, until the last, say, 10 years, were generally white church leaders. It's only in the last 10 years that black church leaders have emerged to lead that these churches in a new way. And that, of course, is another story to which I'll be coming a little later on. Of course, there were other churches that emerged out of the missionary movement, such as churches which are wholly black, like many of the Lutheran churches are just black denominations with no white membership at all. You get that also forming the church of which some of you may know, Manus Buthelezi, who's a Lutheran bishop. His church is a wholly black church, and that's true for most of the Lutheran and for some other churches as well. And then there are the 3,000 African independent churches, perhaps numbering something like 5 million people, and an amazing story, which I wish we had time to go into. These African independent churches that for various cultural, political, and other reasons, broke with both the black mission churches and the multiracial churches, and have created a distinct type of Christianity within the Southern African and South African context. Well, more about that if there are questions along those lines. Let me just get to the point of where I think we need to spend a bit of time, and that is the emergence during the church's struggle against apartheid, the emergence of a new understanding of what the unity of the church is about. Gradually, the churches
who found themselves, these English-speaking churches, found themselves in opposition to apartheid, also found themselves discovering what it meant to be the church together.
Within, excuse me, the ecumenical movement, and particularly the South African Council of Churches, they began to find each other. And today you might say that the churches that are in opposition to apartheid are the member churches of the South African Council of Churches, and the churches that support the government's policy of separate development are the three African churches, with the Dutch Reformed Church, the big one being the main supporter. Or not necessarily the main supporter, they all do, but the most powerful. But one other interesting thing has happened. Remember, way back, I told you that the Dutch Reformed Church, the big white one, created separate churches for its various racial groups, colored, black, Indian. Well, an interesting thing has happened in the last 10, 15 years. These separate black churches within the family of the Dutch Reformed Church have been pushing the white church to the point of saying, we must unite. If we really belong to the same church family, we must all come together. And the white church has been resisting that. And said, now, wait a minute, children. Hang on a moment. We're not ready for that. We're not ready for that. And out of that kind of desire for unity has come the diametrically opposed movement of saying, okay, if you don't want to unite with us, not only will we unite with each other, but we are going to oppose you. We're going to struggle against you. We're going to identify with those churches over there, those English-speaking churches, and the Roman Catholic Church, the Rom Kafar, the Roman Danger. Okay, there's this whole story behind that. We're going to identify with those churches in the opposition to you and the apartheid. And that's an interesting thing that is now happening, that the children, the black children of the white church reform missions, have now begun to revolt against the church that, in a very real sense, gave them birth. And if you're familiar with, yeah, to unite those two churches.
Yeah, at the local church level?
At every level, yeah. Okay? Now that hasn't happened, and there are differences and difficulties, but that's the move. And one of the leaders in that whole thing is a Dutch Reformed black theologian, Alan Busser, who was one of the key speakers at Vancouver, a very articulate, powerful theological opponent of apartheid. Now, this is an interesting new alliance taking place. But you've also got tensions within these English-speaking churches over here. Within my own denomination, we've lost four or five congregations, white congregations, because of our stand against the apartheid. And there are tensions, very real tensions within the church, not only between black and white, but also between blacks, because some blacks have begun to benefit from the system and to identify with it, and others are strongly in opposition to it. So you've got tensions there. In some miraculous way, our church is held together. I'm never quite sure how one can describe it except in terms of miracle. And the same is true for, let's say, the Methodists, who have had the same kind of tensions in the right-wing breakaway on political issues. And that's part of the agony and pain that one goes through in struggling against apartheid, because it's not just struggling against a political philosophy over there, or the government over there, the state over there, but within your own life to begin with, within your own congregation, within your own denomination, there's a struggle that goes on. Seeking to be a faithful church, a very painful thing. The church in which I grew up, the congregation which I grew up, the church in which I was ordained, that congregation, that place, where I had so many friends, where I preached so often, was one of the churches that strange set of circumstances, broke with our denomination because we belonged to the World Council of Churches and were against apartheid. And that was a terribly painful experience for me and for my parents and so on. Well, that's part of what it means to struggle to be the church in South Africa. In that struggle, of course, the state surveys what you're doing, and you can terribly seen that you do it, and there are all kinds of pressures from the state security side as well. The banning of church leaders, the banning of books, and we might go into the whole struggle if you're interested. But I might also say that on the other side, within the Dutch Reformed Church, there have been some very courageous white Dutch Reformed ministers, theologians, members, who have gone against the stream within their church. A minority, but a very powerful minority in terms of their tremendous commitment and strong faith. People like Baez Modi, who led the Christian Institute until it was banned. Baez Modi, an interesting person. His father was a leading Dutch Reformed minister, a powerful figure in the past, one of the leaders in the movement to ensure that Afrikaans and Afrikaner culture had its rightful place in the country. And Baez Modi grew up in that whole environment and became a Dutch Reformed minister of a large, powerful congregation in Johannesburg. But in the process of his spiritual development as a pastor, also within the secret Broederbond, that secret Afrikaner society of Afrikaner intellectuals and elites that is behind the whole thing. At least some people would say, I don't think it's quite like that, but it's a powerful movement within Afrikaner. And he was an important figure there. And people were saying, Baez Modi will one day be Prime Minister of South Africa. Well, gradually, as Baez Modi struggled with the meaning of his faith, he came to break with his church's stand for apartheid, began to oppose it, even as moderator or president of the very powerful synod of the Northern Transvaal. Eventually, he was forced to leave the church. And finally, he ended up as a banned person for 5 years incommunicado, and his banning was just renewed for 3 years last year. Remarkable story. So there are white, Afrikaans, Dutch Reformed people, courageous people, more courageous than us in the other churches where we're swimming with the stream, if you like, although swimming against the general political stream. Yes.
What about banning?
Banning, right. Good question. Banning. It's a particular, or rather peculiar, political method that the South African authorities use to silence people. If they want to silence you and they don't want to go to the trouble of putting you in prison or having a trial or something, which they don't live there to do either, but if they want to silence you because you are a powerful, charismatic speaker or writer or leader of a group or what have you, trade unionist, student leader, clergyman, whoever you may be, they can ban you. And normally a banning order is for 5 years, and it means that you can never meet with more than one other person at a time, except your immediate family. You cannot leave the magisterial district within which you reside. If that happens to be Johannesburg, that's fine. There's plenty of movies you can go to and all sorts of things. If it happens to be Blikkensdorp in the middle of the Karoo, that's not so nice. You cannot publish. You cannot enter an educational or publishing institution. There's one other. The banning orders vary according to the person that accepts it. Sometimes it's for a shorter period. Sometimes some students, many students at our university, when I say many, talking about dozens, have been banned over the last 20 years. Sometimes they've had permission to continue their studies on condition that they do not take a platform or what have you. So it's a fairly effective kind of thing. There were quite a lot of people banned until recently, when the government lifted the banning on virtually everybody except 11, which is a very small number. But Baez Modi is still banned. Well, they could leave the country if some of them have got permission to leave the country. You need a passport to leave, and your passport's taken away when you're banned. So. But some leave and some escape.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that often happens. I mean, we've had banned people preach in our church in Rondebosch, and banned people have preached quite often, and they've never been touched as a result of that. I mean, that would just be too much for the public to be able to handle if they were banned from doing that. Although it's clearly in contradiction to the banning order. Often what happens is that, well, the banned person is the one that's penalized, not the other people. Oh no, the banned person is penalized. So that means that you feel bad about being with that person if there are more than one other, you see, because you might make a difficult choice. Some of the banned people, take it pretty lightly, and they get into court cases and all kinds of other stuff.
But is the South African legal system similar to English? Is it common law or is it
not Roman? No, it's Roman Dutch.
Oh, it is?
It's Roman Dutch. Yeah. And that is quite a different legal system to English common law or American law. Okay. Well now, are there any other questions while we're at this point?
The women?
The women?
You talked about women in ministry really
well. Yeah.
How are women in ministry?
Okay, well, I've been including them all along the line.
Okay.
When I talk about the church, I think. Yeah.
So, the
yeah.
church
Well, the story of women against the father is a very powerful story, and at all levels. My wife gave a talk last week, I think, on the listening as well. It was just a little bit about this. There's a book in the library, I think, here, and it's a film called Women Against the Party. Some of the most powerful church people in South Africa in the struggle against the party have been women. Helen... no, not Helen, but Mrs. Jews, but...
Who's the Anglican woman in the band? Is that anything?
Helen Joseph. Yeah. Helen Joseph was one of the first people to be banned. She's an Anglican who was about anything. Very much involved in the Black Liberation struggle. And she's been, she's under house arrest and all kinds of things. She's been in that sort of twilight world for the last 20, 30 years. Many black women, I've been talking inclusively. When I talked about the church and the struggle, I've been including black and white and male and female. But I think it's good to be reminded that one needs to keep this in mind.
The women have
the white women have
reigned in the church too.
Well, the Dutch Reformed Church is Calvinist in its policy, and the church is controlled by the elders, and the elders in the Dutch Reformed Church have until very recently all been male. At the last synod a year ago, they passed new church legislation which allows the ordination of female women elders and deacons. Not just clergy, ordained ministers, but ordained elders and deacons.
So
you're
saying
that
women have the vote if they're
white? Yeah.
But not black women?
Well, blacks don't have the vote in the overall political structure of the country.
No.
Although new government constitutional proposals are designed to try and include colored and Indian into the white political process. Okay. So that's a whole other... that's just a whole other morning of last week. I suppose you could get into it. Or maybe you need to, I don't know. Well, let me say a few other things and then a few questions, perhaps. The Churches Against the Apartheid came out in 1968 with a message to the people of South Africa, an important document. The story of that is told in my book, and it's about... it was the most thorough-going theological statement on why apartheid was to be rejected as a false gospel. And that caused a great deal of controversy in the country. It hit the headlines for many days, and even brought the wrath of the Prime Minister at that time as D.J. Foster down on the heads of the churches and church leaders for having promulgated this message, which was something like the 95 Theses, if you know about the 95 Theses of Martin Luther, or something like the Barlin Declaration of the German Conservative Church in 1934. And that started a new phase in the Church's opposition to apartheid, in which Bernard Levine and many others were intimately involved, moving from theological critique to trying to provide an alternative way of, so often the politicians would say, okay, you're a Christian theologian, you're critical of apartheid, what would you do if you were in power? How would you set the whole thing right? And so out of the measures of the people of South Africa came a whole bunch of of attempts to imagine, to design a new society. And there were major studies done on law, on education, on the church, on labor, on economic issues. Six areas were explored and proposals made as to how this thing could be done. Well, that's had some impact upon the life of the country, but perhaps more so in the church than anywhere else, because it pointed out to the English-speaking churches, the church report that came out of that, that you English-speaking churches, although in principle you are against the party, in practice you just are part of the culture. I'm supposed to be against it in theory and principle, but if you're not against the part of the practice, then your words are undermined by your lack of action, by your lack of deed. I think the story this last week here to illustrate this point, although we were talking about something else. A friend of mine who was the president of the Methodist Church some years back, about 10 years ago, was deputized by his church's conference to go to the Prime Minister and to say to the Prime Minister that the Methodist Church of Southern Africa believed that the wages paid to black workers within government and civil service being less than those paid to white employees, those wages were totally inadequate, and the principle of